This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. Today I'm speaking with Adrian Mayer, a research scholar at Stanford University, a folklorist, and historian of ancient science. Adrian investigates natural knowledge contained in pre-scientific myths and oral traditions, as well as ancient folk science precursors, alternatives, and parallels to modern scientific methods. Her most recent book, Gods and Robots, Myths, Machines, and Ancient Dreams of Technology, investigates how the Greeks imagined automatons, replicants, and artificial intelligence. Today, we discuss what makes a robot, why there is a timeless desire to create artificial intelligence, as well as the prevalence of war machines and ancient fembots.
But yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for talking to me. And because I remember reading about your book, Gods and Robots, and its Myths, Machines, and Ancient Dreams of Technology a while ago. And I thought, what an interesting concept, because most people just don't think of the ancient world and having robots. And
no, I know. It's interesting. I mean, I have lived in Silicon Valley since 2006, so I was really aware of all this technology, and just being the kind of ancient historian I am, I always want to know when did people actually start thinking that way. And I always suspect that it's much earlier than most people realize. So that's really what inspired me, to just see how deep are those roots.
Yeah. And how deep are they?
And then once you start looking. Yeah,
they go really far back, right?
Yeah, and once you start looking, it's amazing what pops out at you in texts that you've read, you know, in the past many times. You just notice that they were talking about automatons or artificial life.
Maybe we should start with what constitutes a robot in the ancient world. Like, what do you need to be considered robotic?
I'm using the words rather informally, as most of us do, but obviously there are definitions, technical definitions of all these things. A robot is, the definition is even debated today, but basically it means that it's a self-moving device, often in the shape of an android or a humanoid type shape, not always, but it is self-moving and has some sort of inner workings and some sort of power source. So that would be the basic definition that I worked with, for instance, with the large bronze robot in the myth of Jason the Argonauts, Talos, the large bronze robot who guarded the island of Crete. He, in fact, is described as self-moving. He has the ability to interact with the environment, take action, and he has inner workings that are described for us, and he also has a power source. So he does fit the definition of a modern robot. It's really quite amazing. And we know that he was thought of as a technological product, a self-moving techno product in antiquity, because we have vase paintings that show Jason using a tool to dismantle this robot and sort of hack into his inner workings and cause his inner power source to flow out. So those vase paintings are from 5th century BC. So we know that's a really ancient concept.
So is he considered the first robot? Like the most, is he the eldest, oldest, most ancient robot that we have on record?
Yes, I think he has to be considered the most ancient one we have in the ancient sources, because in the classical sources, because he is described by Hesiod, and as we know, that Hesiod is sort of a contemporary of Homer, so that's the earliest writings we have, Homer and Hesiod, and Talos appears there, and many scholars believe that the epic cycle of Jason the Argonauts, where he is really sort of comes to the fore. Jason the Argonauts are the ones who interact with Talos. Many scholars believe that story is much older than the version we have by Apollonius of Rhodes, that it was maybe even from the time of Homer or older. So Talos is certainly the oldest one. Pandora appears in Hesiod too, and she's also made, not born. In other words, manufactured, not reproduced biologically. So she's another automaton, really, a product of artificial life.
So we have different types of ancient robots. How did they compare with regards to the vision that the ancients had with them as opposed to the actual machines that they had? Was there like a huge difference to what the actual technology was versus what the imagined technology could be?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the automatons and artificial life that we have described in Homer and Hesiod and other ancient texts, they're fantasies. They're the earliest science fiction that we have, really. They're sort of people trying to ponder what kind of awesome biotechnology, biotechne, could you produce if you had the cosmic imagination and the skills of a god. And so almost all of these automatons are attributed to the god of invention and innovation, also the blacksmith god Hephaestus. And so people imagine what could Hephaestus achieve using the materials and the techniques and the tools that anyone would see in an ordinary blacksmith of those days, blacksmith forge of those days, but he's a god, so he gets awesome results. And I think the myths are, as I said, they're science fictions. People trying to imagine just what could you achieve. And these stories from the myths of Hephaestus show us that people were able to imagine the concept, the idea of robots and self-moving devices and artificial life much earlier than the technology for such things really existed or was invented. Now, what's interesting to me is that there are some philosophers of science who have argued that no one could imagine self-moving devices or automatons until the technology actually existed, which it just floors me that people would actually put that in writing. Philosophers would say such a thing. Obviously, haven't paid much attention to the actual texts of the myths. And in fact, where does innovation and invention come from if you can't imagine things that don't exist already? So I found that really quite amazing. But you know, most historians, scholars have believed that automatons were first developed in the Middle Ages. And they just assume that you had to have the clockwork inner workings and things like that before you could actually build any. But I started this book by just asking, I wonder if the ideas of artificial life or automatons could have been imagined in classical antiquity. It turns out that they could have imagined such things. And it's sort of, I like to use the word biotechne because I think that that's what the Greeks would have called these artificial beings. It means life through craft, and of course it's similar to our biotechnology. And so there were robots and synthetic beings and self-moving devices appearing in myths about Odysseus, and as I said, Jason the Argonauts, and Medea is always involved, and there's also the legends of the brilliant craftsman Daedalus and Prometheus. And Hephaestus is the guy who's got the resume, though. He's the one with the He's just got a list of all these self-moving devices. I mean, he made these smart automated bellows for his forge. He created driverless carts, these three-wheeled tripods that could come and go, serving ambrosia and nectar to the gods at their banquets and then return when they're empty. Those are driverless carts. He made automatic gates to the heavens that the gods and goddesses wouldn't have to get out of their chariots to open the gates as they came and went from the heavens.
The original garage door, right? The
automatic. Yeah, it's just astounding. And then, but then I think that his crowning achievement was the staff of golden maidens, golden servants that he created to help him. They were supposed to anticipate his every need and helped him in his workshop. And they were endowed, according to Homer, endowed with movement, mind, and this is the most amazing thing, they were endowed with all the knowledge of the gods. So that's quite a data dump there. You don't need all that. but you never know. And so these are an ancient version of AI or artificial intelligence if they've got all the knowledge of the gods, right? I mean, that is massive data ability there.
Leave it to the gods to make something like that, though. You know, they.
Yeah. Once again, it's a science fiction. It's what could Hephaestus come up with if he really put his mind to it and his divine abilities. So I think it's really astounding to me that all of these things existed in Homer and Hesiod, and we just didn't pay attention to them.
You know, it's interesting. You were saying before about how you have the imagination first, and then afterwards we come up with the technology. That you don't need the technology to come up with these ideas. And you know, I was actually even just reading recently, like a Jules Verne book, you know, for fun. And it's another, you know, he came up with so many things that then later on became inventions. So were there a lot of ancient myths that later the ancients created after having the myth?
I think that's a really interesting concept. And as we just discussed, what you need imagination to come up with innovation, to invent things. And many people have said that where science fiction leads, technology often follows. And the Jules Verne example, he's just one of them from modern times. But I think these myths of self-moving devices and artificial life are kind of ancient thought experiments. If you think back to the first flying model of a bird that was an artificial bird, and it was able to fly a few feet or yards, modern engineers have tried to figure out how that could have worked. It was made by a friend of Plato's in the 4th century BC, Archytas, in Sicily. And he was a mechanical genius and also a political leader in Tarentum in Italy. And he invented this model bird that could fly. Today's engineers have figured out that such a thing could be created using steam power. So that's the 4th century BC. Now, there were myths about Hephaestus making the giant bronze eagle that came to torture Prometheus. It's possible that the bat myth might have inspired Archytas to make a bird, but by the Hellenistic period, we've got just multitudes of inventors and innovators and craftspeople and ancient engineers around the Greek world who sort of converge on Alexandria. And you could call Alexandria kind of Silicon Valley of antiquity, I think, because they're all there. Everyone wants to go to Alexandria and build marvelous machines. And they do. They make servants that can serve wine or water. They make self-moving devices. Some of them are miniature, and some of them are monumental. And we don't have any proof, but because many of the themes of these automated devices made in Alexandria in the Hellenistic period refer to mythological scenes or figures, I think it's quite possible that the myths of artificial life might have inspired some of those engineers.
So You speaking about artificial life, and previously you mentioned the idea of biotechnology, life throughout craft. Why do you think it is that there is this sort of timeless impulse to create artificial life? I mean, why do we want to do that? Why do they want to do that? Why do we still want to do that?
That's a good question. And I think that the ancient philosophers actually thought about that too. There's just this human impulse to imitate nature. And if you have gods who can do these things, but then why can't humans do it too? And so people had this impulse to imitate nature and sort of mimic nature. For instance, Pandora is made to look exactly like a real woman. And then comes the idea of, well, if I can imitate nature, can I improve on nature? It just seems to be a natural progression from imitating to improving on nature. And then, can I surpass nature? And I think human beings just tend to do that ever since antiquity. And of course, you know, Sophocles wrote tragedies that featured both Talos and Pandora. Unfortunately, they're lost. So we can imagine what Sophocles would have done with those ideas. And actually, in one of his plays, and I can't remember which one it is that actually exists, he has this sort of paean to human ingenuity, where he praises the audacious nature of humans. They're so bold, they go where no man has ever gone before, and they can borrow superhuman powers from the gods and animals, and they just have the creative power of contriving ways to escape, and he says, imitate the forces of nature. And but then Sophocles ends that sort of praise and encomium to human ingenuity by saying that, don't forget, the outcomes can be both good or evil. I think that in antiquity, people really did take that idea on board. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you say trying to surpass nature, that, you know, immediately you kind of like, uh-oh, that sounds like the big H word, hubris, you know, that's...
Yeah, yeah. And then it also brings up another question that people are really worried about these days. Does technology advance tyranny? Are they linked in some way? And they definitely are. And once again, I tried to look into the roots of that. And it goes all the way back. I mean, if you think about who makes these automatons and self-moving devices, it's gods, and then it's monarchs, and it's usually very autocratic, tyrannical monarchs who use them against their own subjects in the mythology. But then I thought, well, is that just in mythology, or does it occur in ancient history too? And it goes all the way back to the 6th century. That's how far I could trace tyrants being very interested in novel self-moving devices and automatic machines that they could use to torture and kill people. There are real historical monarchs who held contests for inventors to come up with novel ways of killing more and more people. That's how the torsion catapult was first invented. It was a contest to see who could make the best novel inventions for war. So I think tyranny and technology have long been linked.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that with like Archimedes. Obviously, he created
a lot
of pretty evil things. I mean, like the death ray. I mean, he really sounds like an evil genius.
Absolutely, and he had these big winches that could, big claw that could come down and grab up a ship. He invented all these war machines. I guess he just, when you have that invention, you have that consciousness, if somebody's going to pay you to do it, you want to see them actually built and used. So I think he was killed, even though the Romans wanted to capture him alive and force him to work for them. But the soldiers killed him instead. So there's always this idea of powerful states or monarchs or tyrants, dictators, wanting to have the latest inventions and to hire the best innovators and inventors.
Yeah, I often think of Caligula and the Nemi ships, where, you know, and they were sunk to the bottom of the lake after he was taken down because nobody liked him, which good reason. but it was amazing when they took those ships up again to find these ball bearings and all sorts of technology that wasn't like reinvented until the Middle Ages, and a lot of automated bits, right? There's ones to like make gods circle around continuously.
Theatrical productions were really into using self-moving devices, and also in temples too. We know that there were, you could have statues that could raise their arms or blink their eyes or even make sounds, turn their heads, open a door, or light a fire, things like that. Some of it is sleight of hand and magical tricks, but a lot of it must have been with machinery and steam-driven and water driven, and even pulleys and levers, things like that. And as I said, in Alexandria, there were certainly lots of inventions that one of the main motives is to just make a spectacle that shows off the power of the monarch that is in charge of all these inventors. So Ptolemy Philadelphus in Alexandria was a great patron of all these inventors, and he had this grand procession. I think it was in 279 BC, he had this grand procession that took days to travel through the streets of Alexandria, and there were floats that were so heavy they were pulled by 300 men, and on these floats would be large animatronic figures of gods and goddesses. One of them was the goddess Nysa, N-Y-S-S-A. She was related to Dionysus. And she was seated on a throne, and she was 10 feet tall. And periodically along the route, she would stand up and pour a libation of milk from a jug into a bowl and then sit down again. And that has to be a really robust inner workings. That is a robot that it had to do all this in a graceful way that's befitting a goddess. And to the viewers, the people who are watching, it's quite a spectacle, and it just speaks to the power of Ptolemy Philadelphus, who seems to have the gods on his side by having all these spectacular moving models of the gods and goddesses.
Oh, that would have been so amazing to see. I mean, I wish I could just time travel to be able to view it.
Oh, I do too.
It does seem though, so like the main reasons for creating these automations and robots and such, seems like there's war and violence, there's religion and convenience, I guess servants, and entertainment. Is there any other reasons that they would create them, or just to see if they could? Is it just like human?
Well, certainly labor-saving devices. And it's interesting that even Aristotle contemplated what self-moving devices and automatons, what would that would mean socioeconomically. Unfortunately, he didn't follow through on his little asides. It appears in his justification for slavery, natural slavery. And then he just sort of starts musing about, what if we had the self-moving devices and automatons that are described by Homer, made by Hephaestus? What if we really had those in Athens? What if we had looms that could weave on their own? What if we had musical instruments that could play themselves, or ships that could sail themselves? If we had that, we wouldn't need slaves. And then he just drops it. Unfortunately, he doesn't continue with that idea. He goes back and justifies human slavery. But he at least took that idea on board, that if we had automatons, they could be labor-saving devices and would do away with slavery, the need for slavery. It's really frustrating that he didn't follow through on that idea. But I think the fact that he put it in writing in that work, it sort of implies that maybe philosophers were talking about those ideas in antiquity, and we're just lucky enough to see a little glimpse of those debates that people might have had then.
Yeah, I mean, and it is amazing because so many machines have liberated so much of our times. I mean, I definitely get that feeling, you know, when you put on the washing machine, you put it on the dishwasher, you know, you got a few other things going on, but you got your rice cooker going, and then you're like, okay, great. They're all doing my work. I can read a book. You know?
That's right. We depend on these things, and they allow us to multitask and not pay attention to all the things that we really should be doing, I guess. It's a mixed bag, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it can be liberating, but I guess, you know, like I've got friends, they love their Zumba, you know, their Roomba, or whatever those things are called, and, you know, but then you got this, like, annoying thing going by your feet. But I guess that seems, like, pretty innocuous, but obviously there is a lot of danger that does come along with technology, and we it has been used for lots of, you know, incredibly evil, violent things throughout the millennia. And we often nowadays do kind of bring that up from time to time, saying like, okay, should we have AI? Should we think about technology? Did the ancients question the dangerous side of technology and robots? I mean, and AI, were they afraid of it? Did they have that sort of technological moral question as well?
I think that there's a lot of evidence that that the ancients really were grappling with a lot of the same questions that you just brought up, the same qualms about, once again, the sort of double-edged sword of imitating, improving, or surpassing nature. But then what if you can't control it? I mean, if you think about the giant robot Talos, he was created by Hephaestus for Zeus to give to King Minos, who's a tyrant, to guard his island of Crete. And he's created to be a perpetual motion machine who will always guard the island of Crete against invaders. But in the myth, Medea, the great sorceress, and she's kind of she's a techno witch. She figures out how to disable Talos by undoing the bolt on his ankle that seals his whole inner workings and allows his power source, which is Ikor, to flow out. And now he's no longer immortal and he's destroyed. And so there's a lesson there, I think, that even if you have the most superior technology created by Hephaestus, there's always going to be someone who can hack and figure out the vulnerability of that machine and either destroy it or make it work for their own purposes or disable it somehow. So Medea was really a master at doing that. She helped Jason also overcome that unnatural army that was sent by her father, the king, against Jason. And that was a totally uncontrollable army of armed men who sprung up out of the ground and they're programmed to attack. But she figures out what their vulnerability is. If Jason would just throw a stone or two into their midst, they will sense that on their shields as an attack and attack then whatever's nearest to them. So they attack each other and they turn into just a frenzy of attack and destroy themselves. So once again, it's superior technology, but someone was able to figure out the vulnerability. And I think over and over again, we see that in the myths.
And what did the philosophers say about it with regards to day-to-day men using technology? Did they warn against it or did they think it would liberate them?
You know, I don't know of any other philosophers who spoke about technology other than Aristotle mentioning the possibility that automatons or self-moving devices could be labor-saving. I can't really think of any other examples of philosophers talking against them. We do know that people feared, well, there's a famous story of the Spartan general who was first shown the torsion catapult, and he said, now what will become of men's honor? Because he's used to face-to-face fighting. That is how you win honor in war. And if you can be killed by an automatic machine that can hurl boulders from afar, then what will become of military honor? So there's that kind of fear that that the technology can erase the sort of the humanity in that way.
God, can you imagine what he would think of drones today?
Oh, yes.
You're like, there's a guy, he's in a room, he's basically playing a video game and there's like hundreds of people dying on the opposite side of the world. Like,
yes, you know? it's astounding what we've seen just in our lifetime, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, and the change, I mean, within the last 100 years, even, I think from like World War One, or, I mean, you still kind of had combat where people looked at each other, at least when they shot them.
Except that if you think about in classical antiquity, there were a lot of mixed feelings around archers. because they could shoot safely from afar and not face to face. So sometimes archers, even though Odysseus was a famous archer.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, yeah, Hercules, I was like, well, he's also crafty.
But there's still some, there's just mixed feelings about that, ambivalence about people who don't have to, who choose not to fight face to face. They can kill from a safe spot. And then if you use poison arrows, for instance, and people did in antiquity use poisoned arrows, that's even more dubious, because now you don't even have to be a good shot. Just a scratch will kill someone. So people in antiquity certainly thought about those kind of improvements on nature or kind of automated warfare, even when it comes to something as primitive sounding to us as bows and arrows or archery.
Yeah, was it the Scythians, I want to say? Didn't they like having poison arrows?
Scythians, yes, they were much dreaded for their poison arrows. And we even have the recipe. Several ancient Greek sources give us the recipe that they used snake venom, viper venom, and that they then chopped up the vipers themselves and mixed it with human blood and dung, put it in a leather bag, buried it for several months, letting it putrefy, and then dug it up, then dipped their arrows in it. Now that makes you feel really queasy. You don't want to face these archers. And they were also really good aim, and they were famous for their long distance shooting. So, but then you think, why do we know the recipe? The Scythians never even left any writings, and yet we know the recipe from several different authors. And I think there you see the psychological advantage that you get from having that technology of poison arrows, and you disseminate the recipe, and that's sometimes almost enough to keep people from attacking you.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you hear there's dung involved as well.
You think of all the pathogens and the fact that it's human and human blood, it just makes it really creepy. And you know, they didn't even have to use that recipe. They could just use the snake venom. Didn't have to go to all that trouble, right? But it adds to that psychological horror. And that was true for things like Greek fire and naphtha weapons, things like that. The psychological fear is really important as a deterrent.
It's terrifying sometimes to think that the violence and the war, the murder happens to be one of the greater sources of inspiration for technology. it always kind of breaks my heart. Was there any instances where people came up with something that was meant for evil originally, but then got to be used for something positive?
I can only think of the opposite direction, really. It's interesting. Many people point out that automation or automatons, self-moving devices, that you touched on this before, that they're labor-saving, they're for spectacle or entertainment, and they're also for violence and tyranny. But another motive might be sex. If you think about Pandora, she's made as a trap for men. She's made as a absolutely gorgeous, beautiful fembot. She's supposed to be more beautiful than any human woman. And God, Zeus, when he is commissioning this from Hephaestus, says, I want this to be evil disguised as beauty. And she will be able to seduce the guy that we're going to give it to. The perfect patsy. It's Epimetheus, Prometheus's brother. And of course, the names are important there in the Greek myth, because Prometheus means foresight in ancient Greek, and Epimetheus means hindsight. So Epimetheus is a happy-go-lucky guy who goes for the short-term gain, and he's enchanted by Pandora when she's brought down as his bride and accepts her, even though Prometheus, the guy who's always looking forward, foresight, tries to warn his brother not to accept this gift from Zeus. and Prometheus is paranoid with good reason, right? But Epimetheus accepts her into his life, and her only mission on Earth is to insinuate herself into human society and then open that jar filled with everything that plagues humankind, suffering and plagues and disease and death. So she fulfills her mission, and we never hear from her again. But she is a kind of sex bot. There's another one, the story of Galatea. That story is told in Ovid, and the artificial woman is also a very gorgeous, more beautiful, idealized female, and she is a sex bot. He takes her to bed every night, and then he prays to the goddess Aphrodite to bring his ivory statue alive, and Aphrodite takes pity on him. Pygmalion prays to Aphrodite to bring this beautiful ivory statue that he takes to bed every night alive, and Aphrodite does that. I mean, the gods often just do these things to see what's going to happen, I'm sure. they're amused by these human desires. But when Ovid describes her coming alive, she has no agency, no desires of her own. She doesn't even speak. But even creepier, Ovid describes her skin as not feeling like human skin, but feeling like wax that becomes more malleable the more you handle it. And Ovid actually says, Galatea became useful by being used. And it's a really creepy story. And yet we're taught this story as a beautiful romantic love story. But if you actually read it, how it was written by Ovid, Pygmalion doesn't come off very well for inventing the world's first sex doll.
Yeah, I don't know what that says about human nature, if that seems to be kind of a more of the timeless features of sex bots.
Yeah, and a lot of inventive ingenuity is going into making better and better and more lifelike sex dolls who are automated, but of course they have no agency on their own. And so there's some, once again, we already talked about this, maybe technology dehumanizing humanizing force.
So as a sort of like a general question, what can the study of ancient mythological robots sort of teach us today? What's the value in learning sort of this? It seems almost obscure or niche, but I mean, fascinating, but what's the value in our lives for knowing about these ancient robots?
Well, you know, it's we live in a time right now, as we were just talking about, really grandiose ambitions and abilities. We have really futuristic goals that seem to be being met at a terrifying rate right now. And we're trying to reimagine humanity. We're just sort of on the brink of what advanced technology is going to make possible. And of course, by making it possible, it makes it problematic. So it might seem kind of ironic to be looking back to the distant past of classical antiquity. I'm sort of asking people to time travel more than two millennia to study what I said that were essentially the first science fiction stories. But the stories, once you look at them and really study them, they're really sophisticated, and they do seem relevant because they actually do ask and express all of these qualms and questions that we seem to have today. So I think that the relevance and the sophistication of those ancient dreams of technology, they sort of enrich our understanding and grasp of the fact that there's a timeless link between imagination and science. And I think that link goes all the way back to remote, misty past. But I do actually want to point out that the Greeks are not unique in this. they're not the only ancient culture to have imagined these things. It's just that we have a lot of the texts. But I did find examples from Egypt, Persia, India, and China that show similar ingenuity and the desire to imitate, improve on, and surpass nature and make artificial life. And so there are a lot of non-Greek legends from ancient cultures that show that same impulse.
Yeah, I guess it goes to show that technology has changed over the centuries, but human nature and the desire to do more with it is more universal.
And I think the ancient philosophers would probably agree with that. Yeah,
probably. Yeah. So just to finish up, because we're very grateful for the time you've already taken with me today. I know you've had a very interesting career that's spanned various very different themes and research fields and inquiries. So I'm wondering, what are you working on now?
Well, I was very interested in that question of technology and tyranny and the links there. So I had written a little more about that in History Today. And then I'm also very interested in the antiquity of the ancient roots of human enhancements. And you can think about atlatls and archery as the first human enhancements of it. You're actually increasing or expanding the human reach with those technologies, and then all of the prosthetic devices that archaeologists have been able to find, not to mention all the myths about borrowing the powers of gods and humans. So I'm really into that, and an article just came out in a new magazine called Noema that's put out by Washington Post and the Berggruen Institute, and I believe that just came out, on human enhancements in antiquity and their relationship to human enhancements now, which is quite another swiftly advancing field.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. And I think that would be really, really interesting to look, just to make people aware that the idea of human enhancement as well is not a new one. I think that's kind of a trap people often come into with machines and robots and all these things, is just to think this is a modern phenomenon. So I think it's really, really fascinating to make people aware that this is, once again, not necessarily a new thing.
That's right. I don't think you can ever draw a direct line of influence between ancient imaginings of artificial life or enhancements or automatons or inventions, but there is a trend line. You can't just draw a direct line from what they imagined and what we invent now, but the impulse and the qualms are both there. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. And I'll put all relevant links below so readers and listeners can follow up and see your books and articles and learn more about ancient robots and human enhancements.
Thank you. That was really fun. Thanks.